This is Mishmash, a weekly conversation where we try to unjumble an important and sometimes under the radar statewide story that affects you. I'm Shayna Roth.
And I'm Zach Orchow.
This week was budget presentation week at the state capitol. No, hold your horses. They did not finalize a finished budget. Rather, this was more like the governor's wish list, things she would like to see when the legislature does finalize a budget and send it to her desk, hopefully in June, though the governor is pushing for May.
I'm excited to present my executive budget proposal that will keep our progress moving forward. As I said in my State of the State, we have a heck of a record. So let's build on it by enacting another balanced, bipartisan, and fiscally responsible budget.
The budget itself was for $80.7 billion for 2024 to 2025. Zach, you were tracking the presentation this year. What were some of the highlights?
Well, overall, this was a more restrained budget if you're comparing it to the previous year. There weren't these gigantic increases in new programs that we saw in the last few years as a result of the huge run-up in federal aid from COVID. As a result of the big run-up in state revenues. But there is still a lot of increases in this budget, and it is most definitely not a reversion to the pre-pandemic budget that was $58 billion. I mean, this is still 55% ahead of where we were 4 or 5 years ago. But you see K-12 schools, 2.5% increase, universities, community colleges, 2.5% increase. Some new programs here and there, like something where the state will match contributions by state employees who have dependent care needs and issues, more money for drinking water needs and infrastructure. So there are no real major cuts to speak of, but there is certainly less funding this year than in the previous year under the governor's proposal.
Now, the budget presentation has a lot of those big, glamorous points to it that everybody's clamoring and wants to hear about, education, police, things like that. But there are also plenty of important items that tend to fly under the radar. Zach, what are some points that you want to make sure that people don't miss?
You know, we're all about under the radar here at Mishmash. I heard that somewhere.
Yes, we are.
You know, this jumped out at me as I was leafing through the 200 pages of budget documents that I love to read through this time of year. The governor is proposing what looks like a very significant restructure in how Medicaid works for more than 1 million people in the state get their health insurance coverage through some form of Medicaid. So it's very, very important, very significant. The state has contracts with lots of large health insurance plans to administer this, and I guarantee you, they are poring over every word of what the governor's presented today, trying to figure out what this will mean. And it's something we're going to have to really dig into because there's not a lot of detail there yet, but I think it's quite significant. Another item that I think I would say this one probably is a little glossier, but that we're going to be digging into is all of the post-secondary financial aid changes the governor is proposing. In her State of the State speech, she proposed that the state would cover tuition, up to 2 years of tuition, for Michigan high school graduates at community colleges. Today we find out this is going to be part of a consolidation of state financial aid programs. There are programs that probably most of us haven't heard of, called the Tuition Grant. That's a need-based aid program for students at private colleges and universities. Under the governor's proposal, that would go away. Former Governor Granholm tried to get rid of that program for years. It was a war with the legislature. Every year, I'd kind of expect that again. So again, this is, you know, the budget. They like to say, cliche time, where the rubber meets the road. And as we find out today, you know, the governor's proposal for state-funded tuition at community college, there are some strings attached, and if you're a student at a private college or university, you might not be very happy about it.
Boy, I'm pretty sure I've heard the phrase, the rubber meets the road, so many times during Governor Gretchen Whitmer's administration. I feel like that's one of the phrases that she tends to really love, especially this time of year.
Yeah, I feel like I probably should get some sort of demerit for cliche usage there, but it is true, and it's definitely one I think probably the governor's used here and there.
We're actually going to shift gears now and talk about another big item that should be on everyone's minds this year, redistricting.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
We're going to sit down with Gong War's Ben Solis right after this break. Welcome back to Mishmash. I'm Shayna Roth.
And I'm Zach Gorchow.
We're going to shift gears now away from the budget. Make sure you check your feeds in the coming weeks for more on that. Right now, we're going to talk about redistricting and all of the chaos and drama that has been going on with that. And joining us for this discussion is a man who has endured so many hours of redistricting meetings, more than anybody should ever have to. Ben Solis from Gong War. Ben, welcome to Mishmash.
Thank you for having me.
So, Ben, what is the latest in the ongoing saga of redistricting?
Well, we have, nine maps now created by the commission after the federal three-judge panel, overturned the House districts in Detroit. That's seven House districts that had to be redrawn per the judge's order because they violated the Equal Protection Clause. So we have those maps. They are in the court's possession now, and now they are going to a public comment period. And so we will see what the public thinks of these maps. There's a few that I know that the commissioners do like that are, you know, more compliant with the VRA, kind of check off all the boxes, but there's only really three that do meet that number. So we're going to have to see what the other maps are going to look like and what changes are going to be made to the other maps in order for those to comply.
Ben, this whole thing started with a group of Detroiters who said the way the state House and state Senate maps were drawn disadvantaged people in Detroit who are Black from electing their candidate of choice, that the city, which historically had anywhere from 8 to 10 districts, almost wholly contained within the city, was instead kind of sliced and diced, thin strips of Detroit appended to thin strips from the suburbs. And as a result, there were fewer Detroiters, and particularly fewer Detroiters who are Black, elected to the Michigan House and elected to the Michigan Senate. Based on what you've seen so far, and there are a lot of variations, and you and I dug through some of them the other day, do these maps do what the plaintiffs in these lawsuits wanted, give more of an opportunity?
On the surface, potentially. One of the main things that they have been working on to amend the maps after they drew the initial lines was to make sure that they are VRA compliant. And the new mantra and advice from their attorneys is that if these are going to be defensible in court and really give the opportunities to Black Detroiters that I think that they're seeking, they need to have at least 10 opportunity districts, but 11 or 12 would be ideal. And it looks like the three VRA-compliant maps that we've seen, there's actually four, but the newest three that they just created, have anywhere between 11 and 12. So there are more opportunity districts available in these maps. It's also, you know, hard to tell if that's going to change. Based on any kind of adjustments they might need to make after public comment. But I know that the two that have 11 districts they feel more comfortable with, there is one with 12, and I believe one of the individual maps has 12 too. So there might be an opportunity for them to kind of even shift further to try to reach that 12 number. That's really what's going to do it in their mind, and especially if these maps are going to be defensible in court, is are we going to be able to create these opportunity districts that do elect Black leaders, but also do not violate the VRA, because some of those districts, as they are, even though they are opportunity districts, they're pretty packed. They have a lot of Black voting age population. And I think that's maybe a little bit of a concern for some of these commissioners, because that's really what got them here in the first place. So.
And just to clarify, the VRA is the Voting Rights Act.
Yes, the U.S. Voting Rights Act.
And one thing that I'm really interested in is the playing field that this is creating for Democrats and Republicans, because I know that several years ago when this redistricting process was, even before it was passed by the voters, a lot of Democrats were seeing it as sort of their their great key to power in Lansing. Do any of the maps so far dramatically alter the playing field between Democrats and Republicans?
Not at first glance, no. A lot of those partisan fairness numbers on the maps are very similar to the Hickory map that was passed in 2021, the adopted Hickory map. So, you know, it's not too much of a variation. Some of these partisan fairness scores still lean Republican, and that was the case in 2021. Some of the vote share totals that are maybe a little bit of a clearer view of how many, you know, seats Democrats or Republicans are going to potentially pick up based on bellwether elections that they analyzed, that leads still Democratic. And that was pretty much how it shook out in the first round. Even with those lean Republican areas, as we saw, Democrats cleaned up with that previous map. So it's hard to say. Obviously, you know, the Republicans are really vying for a big pickup this time. This could help them, but it's hard to say at this point.
And Ben, we've talked about this quite a bit, that one of the problems the commission has right now is they were specifically found in court to have violated the Equal Protection Clause by doing things like talking about bringing the black voting age population in these districts down to 35%, 30%, really drawing districts with race as a predominant factor. And yet, their task before them now is to still assure opportunity for black voters to elect their candidates of choice. These two things seem completely at odds with each other. How are they handling trying to mesh these two things together?
Very carefully. The first big order of business for them was to go back and draw these maps without considering race at all. And that was one of the big points in the order, was that you cannot draw these lines primarily with that being the predominant factor. So they struggled mightily to redraw maps based on communities of interest, based on equal population. And then once they had all of those metrics kind of, you know, figured out, including partisan fairness, then they had to go back and reconsider race as they amended lines. As you said, yeah, that seems incongruous with the, you know, the court's order. But per their attorney's advice, you know, if you're making small, narrowly tailored changes to the map lines, lines that you've already drawn completely race blind, it is okay, at least in their attorney's eyes, to make those changes based on race and try to create those opportunity districts well after the fact you've already drew those lines. So that is where they were kind of at with that in particular. They did not want to consider it. Some of the commissioners kind of even took themselves out of the situation, turned off their cameras while these race considerations were going on. But they will have to consider race in order to meet the Voting Rights Act. There's just no way around it. And I think their attorneys have made that pretty clear. So yeah, it's a fine balance. And the one way that they navigated it was first and foremost drawing these race blind.
I'm curious, this feels like it has been a very drawn out process from what was, I don't want to say promised, but maybe what was expected when voters went to the ballot box a few years ago and said, yes, I am all for redistricting, let's do it. What has been sort of the general community reaction or the reaction from the public that you've been hearing about when it comes to figuring out where exactly our district lines should be?
It really depends on their level of interest. Folks that have been following this process pretty closely, even in the beginning, knew that the commission was going to get sued over something. There was always an insinuation that lawsuits would come in a you know, number of ways. There were several that were thrown out of the courts that never really got this far or resulted in them having to go back and make map changes. This one was the unfortunate situation for the commission, at least, where they had to go back and make these changes. But this is also just the House map that they're building now. They still have to remedy the Senate map, which also had districts that were thrown out for the very same reason. They're not doing that right now because the priority is getting, you know, a decent House map, a workable House map before the candidate filing deadline in April. And then they'll go back and do the Senate map. So even after this process is done, they still have to draw another configuration for Detroit. And, you know, who's to say that these new configurations that they are drawing now aren't going to be subject to litigation later, or, you know, something else will shake out from the elections. So those who have been following it, I think, really truly understood that this could last several years, whether it's dealing with the lawsuits, redrawing, handling, you know, general business. But I think the general public really was confused on why they were going back to do this in the first place. One of the common criticisms, or rather pieces of feedback that I heard from Detroit residents during this process, and this is mostly coming from the commission's own, you know, admissions, that they really didn't understand why they were redrawing them. You know, they thought that this was actually part of maybe a process with the Detroit City Council of redrawing those lines. There was some, you know, much confusion about what lines they were actually redrawing. They're working hard to try to get that outreach out there and make sure that people come to these public, you know, input meetings. But that took some doing. If you watch the first couple of meetings they had in Detroit for public comment, that room was empty. And, you know, albeit it was in the middle of the day, you know, working people have a hard time getting out to things like that, you know, during the middle of the day. But, you know, outreach has been a bit of an issue this time because it has just been so, you know, swiftly moving. I don't think that people have had a chance to really digest some of this. They're hoping that in this next round, where it's just fully public comment, that they'll have a lot of people. There's a lot of outreach with churches. So I think the you know, awareness will get better there. But there was a period for a couple of weeks where people were confused on why were they even doing this in the first place.
So once the commission settles on a map that it's going to take to the U.S. federal court panel, three judges, and says, this is the map, is it all done? Or what happens next? There's a chance that the court could take this over, isn't there?
Yes, there is. So one of the caveats of all of this is that, you know, the commission, as it stands, is kind of mired in their own chaos. They've been infighting. They've had, you know, administrative issues. Three commissioners resigned. They had to get three new commissioners, you know, in tow to get back into the map drawing process. I don't believe, and based on their own comments from sitting there in court and listening to this, that the three judge panel really had a lot of confidence that they could get this done. So in order to ensure that they would have a map that worked and on time, they did appoint a special master to start drawing an alternative remedy house map. We have not seen that map. There's still questions on whether that map will be made public during this process of the commission finishing their work and then getting it approved by the court. But that option is certainly out there. Should the commission fail to remedy what the court wanted them to, or if they sleepwalk themselves into another violation in the process of drawing these maps, the court could say, thank you very much. We appreciate your efforts, but we're going to take a look at what our special master has drawn up. And if that's the case, well, then, you know, that's a map that was not drawn by this commission. Some people have speculated whether that completely bucks the spirit of this amendment. And it's another situation where, you know, government has drawn these maps and not the people. It's potentially very, very much potential that that could happen.
How has the commission been doing? I mean, there's been people quitting. There's been a lot of backbiting. There's been some infighting. How do things stand now with the members, and how have they gotten sort of to this place?
I will say that when they did not have work to do, a lot of this got worse. A lot of this infighting hit more of a fever pitch. Since they've been, you know, drawn back into redrawing the maps, for lack of a better word, I have noticed that they have put some of these issues aside. A lot of the sniping that I saw over the past year before they went back and started drawing again has kind of calmed down. But it's very clear that the process in 2021 created some bad blood between commissioners, accusations of malfeasance, accusations of, you know, using their, you know, commission posts for personal gain, you know, accusations between each other about whether they really have communities of interest in Detroit at their heart. So, yeah, it's been a little tough to see them fight like this, especially since they have such a huge task to do. It kind of looks like, you know, some other local governments or things like that where, you know, these tensions can run high and cause these situations. But, you know, we'll see if they can continue to put that aside, because they still have much more to do, whether that's with the House map or with the Senate map. And on Thursday, they actually are going to take a vote on whether they are going to consider expelling Commissioner Anthony Eid from his seat. There has been a notice to vacate that was filed by Commissioner Rebecca Zitella, accusing Eid of pretty much the things that I mentioned, malfeasance. There's an insinuation that he drew a map in favor of Noah Arbit to make that district favorable for him. He's denied that vehemently. But, you know, that's what's ahead of them in this kind of down period while they're waiting for this public comment. They have to deal with this administrative issue on whether one of the commissioners who's been there from the beginning is going to get kicked off of his seat. There's a constitutional process for that, and they're going through that right now. But again, that's another piece of uncharted territory that we're in with this commission is, you know, how do they handle their own internal business? And is that okay? So it's tough to watch, but we'll see.
Noah Arbit, state representative from West Bloomfield. Yep. District was drawn that kept West Bloomfield intact. Arbit has said he didn't have anything to do with trying to help himself, that West Bloomfield had long wanted to not be busted up. The commission, of course, has had its deep critics and deep supporters. What are they saying about how all this is playing out? Because this really has ended up with really a panel of citizens who don't have any expertise or knowledge trying to undertake this deeply difficult task. And the supporters of this, it seems like they're saying, like, let's stand by these folks. And the critics are saying, we knew it. But what are you hearing there?
Pretty much that. You know, the people who are true believers and still believe that this is an ideal or at least superior process to what we had before still believe that it's working as intended. It was going to be bumpy. It was not going to be easy, and it was going to be a little messy. And there was always the potential that this could go as long as we're seeing it go now. Those individuals who do support what they're doing continue to show out and give them public comment. They continue to kind of rally the troops and you know, kind of cheerlead them on during some of these meetings, saying, you know, keep going. Like, I know this is awful right now, but what you're doing is important, and you're doing important work. On the converse of that, and we can see that in a lot of, like, the YouTube live comments, individuals who are regulars at public comment disparaging the commission, they're not having any of it. They kind of have a sense of, we told you so. We told you so at the beginning of this process that this wasn't going to work. Here we are in the midst of infighting and you know, drawing a remedy map per a court order. I think this is evidence that it's not working, they say. And that's their words, not mine. But yeah, it's tough to say. I will say this, though. During the court hearings, and this is not during the trial, but, you know, in the post-landing of the trial, trying to figure out how they were going to get this remedy map drawn, there was an individual who has been kind of critical of the commission from the get-go, who was sitting in on those proceedings and walked out with a big smile on his face. And I had asked this person, like, you know, what'd you think? And it wasn't a criticism of what they had done thus far. It wasn't a criticism of how they were going to go forward. His only comment to me was transparency. Like, this is, I can sit here in a courtroom and understand what went wrong with this map and how it was, you know, created every single day of this trial and afterwards. So even, you know, these people who may want this commission to fail, they're still engaging in the process, and they're still getting something of value from having this deep window into what they're doing. It's tough to say, but, you know, I think for the most part, people are generally happy that they know what's going on.
Ben Solis from Gong War, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to our guest, Ben Solis from Gong War. Mishmash is produced by WDET, Detroit's NPR station, in collaboration with the Gong War News Service. Mishmash is hosted and produced by me, Shayna Roth, and Gong War's Zach Gorchow and Alethea Kasbin. Additional production and editing is by Hearns Laguerre Jr. Mixing, mastering, and music is by Sam Bobian, and our digital team is Dave Kim, Sophia Joswiak, and Jenny Sherman. Our news director is Jerome Vaughn, and our podcast manager is David Lyons. As always, if you listen to this show and you want to support it, you can do so by leaving us a review or a comment wherever you listen. You can also subscribe or follow us on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure you tell your friends about how much you have learned from Mishmash. Send them a link. Get them listening. We want to grow. We want to have a nice little Mishmash community going on here. And remember, we're produced by a public radio station, which means we are listener supported. So if you really, really like this podcast, you can support WDET by going to wdet.org/give and becoming a member of WDET at wdet.org.